Jesse Cook is here. The Canadian guitarist and composer is a Juno Award winner, 11-time nominee, a platinum recording artist 10 times over, Player's Choice Award winner with Acoustic Guitar Magazine, a talented producer, filmmaker, and yes, a career that has spanned over 25 years. Five of his concert tours have been produced for PBS television specials. His career took flight in 1995 with that beloved Tempest record, a spirit that has been recently revisited. Jesse Cook was actually born in France and would visit the country in the summers and found his way to flamenco guitar. Here in Toronto, he attended the Eli Kastner Guitar Academy, the Royal Conservatory, and York U, eventually landed at Berkeley. His recording and touring career has taken him around the world, and more recently, the lockdowns honed his skills as a filmmaker. And ahead of a world tour, he's going to play 10 dates here in Ontario beginning on Wednesday in Oakville. JesseCook.com for tickets. It's always a great day when Jesse Cook is around. Welcome to the New Classical FM.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Good to see you again. Yeah. And it's funny, you know, I've been through your bio numerous times and we've talked a couple times over the years, but one thing I never knew is that when you were a kid in France, you lived next to the singer of the Gypsy Kings. I never knew that. I'm a huge fan of that ensemble, that group. They go out once in a while, I guess, do they still?
I think now they have kind of, you know, broken up into two groups. So
right.
There's basically...
like the Beach Boys.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. There's two families, right? There's the guitarist family is Tonino's group. I think they're the Biliardis or something. And then Nicolas Reyes, the other family, they're the singers. They all play the guitar, but if you, you know, they're one side, one family's really good at singing, the other's really good at guitar.
Pretty iconic voice on that guy.
Oh, yeah. No,
holy smokes.
Sure.
Like, you just hear it in your mind. You think Gypsy Kings and you hear that little rasp.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I think they took flamenco to a place that flamenco had never been before. First of all, their style is the Camargue style, so it's the south of France. They were gypsies from Spain that, you know, during the Spanish Civil War left and resettled in France, and then several generations later, you know, that tradition continued and kind of morphed, and guys like Minitas de Plata and José Reyes, you know, during my parents' generation, continued the tradition. And then those two guys, I think their grandkids are the Gypsy Kings. And, and you know, by then they sort of found this sound that was somehow traditional and pop all at the same time. And it just took over the world. Right?
So what was that experience for you? I mean, were you hearing music? Were you just having conversations? Were you just kind of aware of that they were there?
Or? Yeah. So it's funny. My dad was from Canada. My parents were Canadian, but they moved to Europe in their 20s. And my dad spent the rest of his life in Europe. He lived in Paris. He was a photographer. Then he went to Vienna and became a filmmaker. And eventually he
retired. I kind of get it. It's really nice.
Yeah. No, well, it's weird. It's my weird family. But they eventually he retired to Arles in the south of France. And he just happened to buy a house, like this little tiny place in the Gypsy Burial. And his neighbor was Nicolas Reyes. Now, we didn't know at the time, you know, this is a singer, because they weren't famous yet. They were just like this local band. And my dad would, like when I'd visit, I was deep into guitar by then, and I'd visit, and you'd just see gypsy kids walking around the neighborhood playing that way where they're pounding on the guitar like it's a percussion instrument, right?
Like, what did you make of that?
I loved it.
Yeah,
because they didn't have that at the L.E. Kastner Guitar Academy or at Berkeley.
They didn't have it anywhere. It was only there.
It was there, yeah. I mean, like, that's the other thing. Even, like, Paco Lucía, the great, you know, greatest flamenco guitarist ever. But, you know, the Spanish tradition, those golpes, as they call them, where you hit the guitar, they're with one nail. They're not pounding the guitar with their whole fist. You know what I mean? It's not meant to make you dance. It's meant to, you know, mark out the compas.
They do it with a little finesse. Yeah.
Finesse. See, for me, that I feel like that's a judgy term. I don't want to like dismiss the Gypsy Kings. They're interested in different things. I feel like, you know, Paco was all about virtuosity.
Right.
And I feel like the Gypsy Kings was all about the party. You know what I mean? Like, it's the dancing. It's that, you know, it's got to make you want to get up and dance.
Yeah. And you've been trying to do that and doing that ever since. You've been, I guess you took some of that with you.
Well, yeah. So my dad, I remember, you know, he had played me some albums of theirs and said, this is a local band.
Yeah.
And then one night, I think we were actually listening to that record. And then took the, you know, when I stopped the record, we heard somebody else playing what we thought was the same record. And in fact, it was a jam. And we went up to the roof. And, you know, there in Europe, they don't have front yards and backyards. They have like little tiny courtyards and they have rooftop patios. So we went to the roof, and on the neighbor's roof, there was this gypsy jamboree going on. So my dad grew up my guitar and stuck it in my hands and said, strum, you know, so I strummed and they all turned around. They're like, hey, Benny. Next thing you know, we're, you know, I'm jamming with the Gypsy Kings. Wow. At 19. Like, it was amazing for me. Cause I, at that point, I already loved Paco and, you know, Al DeMille and John McLaughlin, all that fusion stuff. So I was, you know, I was already deep into that, and what they were doing, this kind of more party stuff, I was new to me, and I didn't know how to do the rhythm yet that they were doing. I was doing the soloing. So that night I was soloing like crazy, but meanwhile, super envious of like how they could, you know, sound like a whole band just playing one guitar.
And I mean, that just, as you pick a bit of that up and are watching it, I mean, that just adds a little something to the whole soul of the operation, right? Just watching what
yeah.
goes on there.
Well, and there's historic roots yeah. in all of that, right? Yeah. And you can hear it when they play. Like, they're not just making it up as they go along.
Yeah, yeah,
it,
yeah.
It's something that's evolved from, you know, Cuba or something originally. I came back. And now I think with the internet, anybody anywhere in the world can Google how to do that rhythm and learn how to do it. But at that time, nobody knew how to do it because nobody – you had to actually kind of sit in front of somebody and see them do it and go,
there is yeah. some value yeah. to that experience, you know
yeah,
what I mean?
For
you know,
sure.
You know, I
for
think,
sure.
And just being in that place. Also, I love this. I don't know if I'd heard this one either. Your music was actually on a listings channel, and that's how a lot of people heard you in the first place.
It's funny because, you know, I think there were several things that really
launched my
career.
It's like the Weather Network.
Yeah.
It's like the Weather Network.
No, it was the TV Guide channel, actually.
Okay, right.
And the TV Guide channel, I owe it a great debt because I think without the TV Guide channel, I probably wouldn't have even tried this. Like, it was this thing where I was a composer and a producer, and they were using some music that I'd written as background music. And every time a guitar piece of mine came on, the switchboard would light up with people saying, oh, what CD is that? We want to buy it.
Wow.
And they hunted down whatever their music department, and they gave them my number because there was no CD.
It's like one guy.
Yeah. You know, and people are phoning me at home going, I want to buy the CD. And I go, I'm sorry, I'm a background guy. I don't do that, right?
Oh.
By the end of the year, I thought maybe I should. So I recorded Tempest. And it became a story that sort of helped me get exposure in Canada. But really what, you know, kind of launched my career was I released the album independently and at the same time started sending packages to the States and got a bunch of offers for record deals, signed within about a month, and the record company got me into the Catalina Jazz Festival that September. So it was like June, the album came out in Canada independently, signed in July, Catalina in September. I played that first weekend. I came home and my album had debuted at number 14 on the Billboard charts. It
my
was
goodness.
Crazy. Yeah, it was
what
just
a weird time, weird year.
Well, yeah, and I feel like I missed out on, you know, paying my dues, like playing gigs in bars and doing, like I went from like home studio to theater, you know what I mean? Like
Let me ask you about that, because you've spent, you know, you self-produced that first record. I went and saw Brian Eno give a talk about 10 years ago. It was a fascinating conversation of what he had to say about everything, about life. But one of the things he said, I'm going to try and spend a little less time in the studio as I get older, because I've spent my whole life in a studio.
Yeah.
And you've spent a lot of time in a studio. I mean, what's the relationship at this point,
I built my first studio in my mom's basement when I was about 16, and it was like Radio Shack cassette decks and Radio Shack mixers. It was just like whatever my friends had, we'd stick it together and make records. And then I've always had a studio. When I was a music student, I had a little cassette based four track, and I was writing and composing.
Right.
And then, you know, it wasn't just Tempest. I self-produced every album, and I mixed most of them myself. All the PBS specials, I mixed them myself.
Wow.
It's one of those things where...
Is that out of pleasure or out of control?
Probably both. I love it. I should be better at, you know, sort of relegating. And a few times I have, like, there were a few records where I was like, I need to let other people do this and see how it goes. So.
Yeah.
I had the great Al Schmidt mix half of the Roomba Foundation, and George Sierra, a great Toronto engineer, mixed the other half. Just because I wanted to see what it would sound like with somebody else.
Well, you get to a certain amount of records, too, where you sort of go, I wonder if somebody else can put a different spin on this.
Well, exactly. Yeah. And I co-produced some tracks with the Afro-Celt Sound System guys in England. And So they mixed a few tracks for me. You know, we sort of did some co-productions, and I just to see how they would, what would they do with this stuff?
So you like it and you like the control, but you're still comfortable being in there, because I sometimes go into these four walls every day. I'm in here recording things all the time, and I just go, I wonder when I'm going to be ready to not be in a soundproof box.
Yeah. No, I think there are some people who are really great at bringing together talent in a room and letting them do their thing. And certainly with the live show, I try to be good at that. Like, I bring people who've got something to say musically.
Yeah, you do. I've seen iterations of your band, and it's always fascinating who you've found.
And I don't want to put too much, like, you know, expectations. You need to do this or that. I kind of let them find their part in the music and then fix it if it's a problem. But otherwise, they're there because of who they are, right? But I find in the studio, there's a point where, you know, there have been things that I had other people do, or eventually I go, I'm just going to redo it. You know, like I had other people, we had some fancy engineer in Chicago at a big studio in Chicago mixed my first PBS special, and it was terrible.
Wow.
It wasn't just me. Everybody that heard it was like, oh my God, this sounds terrible.
It's like somehow he didn't understand what the music was or what.
No, exactly. And at the same, you know, he was also doing Elvis Costello's record, so he was a great engineer.
Right.
He knew what to do with rock or pop music or whatever, but he, you know, with this weird, like, you know, when he's sort of saying, what's a djembe, you know, and you go, that's a djembe. And so if he doesn't know how to pronounce it, he certainly doesn't know what it's supposed to sound like.
And the nice part of you being in the business this long is that, you know, that there you go. That's a badge earned for you. You've been through that. You had to remix it. And, you know, these are mistakes that don't happen again, right? Hopefully.
Maybe except I sort of feel like, you know, I'm envious of, I remember for, I was working on a record, Nomad, and I was in England.
Big record?
It was a big record, yeah. I was in London working with the Afro-Celt Sound System guys, and
I saw them. Remember they have the Ottawa Blues Fest, which is one of their biggest festivals they have. It is the biggest festival they have in Ottawa.
Yeah, yeah.
They brought it to Toronto for 2 years, and that was one of the groups I went to see.
Oh, yeah.
But it was short-lived.
Yeah.
Yeah. Great ensemble.
No, they were amazing. Yeah. They're amazing. And in the middle of it, I went down to Cairo to record, you know, with Hossam Ramzi, and it was great. It was like this big thing. The whole process was 2.5 years. And I remember I was like in the studio in England, and I'm talking to my manager, who also managed Diana Krall. And he says, oh, you know, Diana's going into the studio tomorrow to record a new record. And I was like, oh, awesome, right? I'm midway through my record. And then like a week later, I'm talking to him, and he goes, oh, yeah, she's finished now. And I'm like, what? You know, my album has sort of moved 2 inches and she's done, you know. And that was where I was like, yeah, because she doesn't sit around sweating all this stuff.
Right.
She's writing, she's playing standards. She doesn't sit and write it and do all this, you know, which I kept thinking, she's brilliant. That's what I should do. Why don't I do that? Why don't I just let all these other people do this? Somehow it's not me. I seem to need to do it all myself. Maybe it's as you said, maybe I'm a control freak.
I love it. I love the stories. And if you're just joining us, Jesse Cook is here, the multi-platinum Juno award-winning guitarist, setting out on a 10-day Ontario tour ahead of what I think is going to be a bigger world tour. Is that right?
Yeah, we go to Europe in May and the U.S. in July and September and Quebec in November.
JesseCook.com for those tickets. Yep. A couple dates to keep in mind. At the Rose in Brampton on the 24th, Oakville this upcoming Wednesday. And, you know, something I should point out, too, we very much keep you as our own, Canadian, and we think of you in perhaps the parameters of this country, but huge success in these other regions of the world, Poland, India, Iraq, in different Olympic Games. And it's what's nice about this music is that it can kind of just take off in these different regions of the world, and it's universal that way.
It's funny, too, because for a while, 50% of my followers on Instagram were from Iran.
Wow.
It was just, you know, all Iranians. You know, like my biggest five cities were like Tehran and all these cities, you know, and like, you know, Toronto and Montreal, way down the list. And I'm like, what? It's sad because I'm like, I'm not sure I'm ever going to get to go and play in Iran, you know, with the politics and those sort of issues. I'd love to play for the fans because they're wonderful.
You get these little windows with that country, right? I know you can travel there and then they kind of back off. And it's tough. But anyway, the records will have to suffice.
Yeah, exactly.
But pretty cool.
Yeah.
That there's this great popularity in some other place, far off land.
Yeah. Well, that's the beauty of the internet, is that in the old days, You know, you needed a record company to release it somewhere for that to be heard. And now people find it wherever it is. And,
that's true. Yeah. One thing that you did, and we talked during this time, is that during the lockdowns, you wanted to stay active and you wanted to record. And so one thing, you really started to work on your video and production skills, and you were working at home and filming these incredible videos. And I have to say, it was pretty impressive.
Oh, thank you.
They're beautifully shot and everything looked great.
Thank you. Well, I don't want to pretend like I just started then.
I know you hadn't, but you got to drill down a little bit.
I filmed my first music video maybe 10, 15 years ago. Right. And then I started doing all my videos from them, because there was a certain point where I realized record companies weren't going to fund, you know, a $100,000 music video for an artist like me. It didn't make sense once the internet showed up.
Not anymore, those days are over.
It wasn't happening. And I sort of thought, if I want to have videos, I got to make them myself. So I started making videos. And at first, it was just for the fun of it.
Right.
And then I started producing my own PBS specials. And then the last one, I actually directed it and edited it myself.
Wow.
And it was just two of us did it, myself and a roadie in my group.
You got to know the cameras. You got to know something about lighting. It's all that stuff, right?
Yeah. Luckily when we're doing a show, the lighting is being done by the lighting director. Like, it's not just, you know, available light. It's beautiful light because they're lighting the show.
Sure.
But the cameras and all that, we would be flying GoPros up, you know, in the lighting rig and up over there. But it was just two of us. It was this roadie and me. And you know, we'd set up stabilizers and all these, you know, kind of, motorized sliders and things on stage. And then we would record every show on our Canadian tour. And then I had this just daunting task of trying to edit it all together to make it one concert.
Yeah.
And then, as you said, during the pandemic, suddenly there was no touring, and I thought, the first year I kind of thought, we're going to get back on the road. And then I realized, no, we're going for a second year of sitting at home. I thought, okay, I need a hobby. I'm going to go crazy. So
right.
I just started filming these videos, and I did one a week, and I would do all the recording and then engineer it and master it, and then start filming it, and then get it posted by Friday and start again. And it was like one of those, you know, those movies with the doomsday clock that resets, and once it sets, it's like countdown 24 hours.
That's right.
You know?
Yeah.
And that was my week. Was every I'd post on Friday, and it's like, okay, 7 days till the next one.
Right.
And I did that for, I can't remember how many I did, 30-something, and then I just collapsed. I was like, okay, I loved it, but I need the break.
I remember when I tried to do a podcast, like a full podcast with, you know, music and guests and research and everything while I was still here, and you're trying to do it on your own, and it was just such a massive undertaking. I remember just feeling like, I'm worn out after doing a season of
that. Well, that's every night, like staying up till midnight, you know, color grading and all this stuff, and learning. Like, the music part was easy, right?
Yeah.
The engineering, like I have those skills.
No problem.
Yeah, but the color grading was that was half of it for me, was just learning color. I didn't really understand it.
Well, they're beautiful, and I recommend everybody go have a look at them, and you get some wonderful music out of it too. By the way, closing in on 1 billion streams.
I know, crazy.
Of your music. How about that?
It's so weird. I realize, like, for a K-pop band, that's like one song for them, but you know, for a guy who plays acoustic guitar, I can't believe it. I'm in shock.
So you're on the road, and it's Oakville, it's Sarnia, Guelph, Brantford, Markham, Richmond Hill, Huntsville, Brampton, Kingston, St. Catharines. Nice grouping.
Yeah, thank you.
A nice little tour around our province.
Our province. Yeah. I think some of them are sold out. I think Oakville, Markham, and Richmond Hill are sold out, but I think Brampton, I think the Rose still has some tickets for people in the Toronto area.
Go to Brampton.
Yeah, definitely.
Go to the beautiful Rose.
Yeah.
Nice to go there.
Exactly.
And it, as always, it is jessecook.com. And we could talk forever. I'm so glad you dropped in. It was fun to hear some stories. And
Thank
I wish you more and more continued success.
Thank you. My pleasure. Thanks for having me.